Support for this podcast comes from Is Business Broken, a podcast from BU Questrom School of Business. Stick around until the end of this podcast for a preview of a recent episode exploring the history of investors holding businesses accountable and the dawn of the ESG, or Environmental Social Governance, movement.
From NPR and WBUR Boston, I'm Anthony Brooks, and this is On Point. Domestic workers, those who take care of the sick and the elderly and who clean our homes, have been among the hardest hit during the coronavirus pandemic. For a long time, they've worked without a safety net, and the pandemic and economic crisis have amplified their vulnerability. Many of them work long hours for low pay without health insurance. These service jobs will become even more essential as a generation of Americans continue to age and require at-home care. This hour on Point, fighting for the rights of the nation's home care workers. With us to start off the hour from Atlanta is Linda Walton. She's a domestic worker and member of We Dream in Black, an organization that aims to strengthen and expand the power and voices of African-American home and home health aid workers. Linda Walton, welcome to On Point. Thanks for joining us.
Hi, thank you for having me.
Tell us a little bit about your experience, if you would. What do you do for work? And describe a little bit what it's been like during the pandemic.
Yes, thank you. I'm a home health care provider for seniors and for people with disabilities here in Atlanta, Georgia. I've been in healthcare for 15 years, but I've been doing domestic work for 3 years. I chose domestic work out of honoring my grandmother. My grandmother was a domestic worker in Alabama, and so was my great grandmother. And it's so natural for me. I have the heart, the love, the capacity for this type of work. And I've decided to do domestic work here in Atlanta, Georgia.
Right. And tell us what you have seen during the pandemic, or how the pandemic has changed some of your concerns or heightened some of your concerns about the work that you do.
Well, what I've seen, a lot of fear at first, because we were working business as usual when the pandemic hit. So with that, there was a lot of questions about health and safety for ourselves and our clients. And working through the agency, we weren't getting any type of information at first. A lot of the information that I received was through my organization, We Dream in Black, National Domestic Workers Alliance, from the watching the news and, you know, going on to the CDC website, kind of doing my own research. So I had a bit of a fear because we weren't, offered the PPE at first. We kind of, trial and error. My particular client offered hand sanitizer, gloves. These are things that he paid for himself for us. However, as the pandemic went along, the company began to reach out to us and ask us, were we displaying any type of symptoms, signs and symptoms? Had we been around people who had the COVID virus? We also, my company started a town hall call. So they sent us a number we could call on Fridays to get information, to find out more about COVID-19 and what the signs and symptoms are and what to look for, how to protect ourselves and our families and our clients.
Right.
So
it sounds like, Linda, that really what was missing, at least at the beginning of this, was just clear information about safety, about how to stay safe, about how to do your job and remain as safe as possible. That information just wasn't there for you at the beginning, it sounds like.
That's correct.
Right. So And it occurs to us as well, you know, in preparing for this show, that a lot of folks like you could find yourselves in difficult, and do find yourselves in this difficult decision, facing a difficult choice between going to work and risking your health, or maybe making the decision to stay home, but then you're risking your livelihood. This seems like a really difficult set of choices.
Yes, it is. It's very difficult because of the type of work that we do, domestic work. It came out of slavery, and it came out of Black women in the South providing domestic work for white families. And when the New Deal came along in the 30s, we were cut out of any type of worker type job security benefits, things of that nature. Some of the Southern politicians, a part of the New Deal was, you know, we don't want those type benefits for the domestic work. It wasn't considered like a valued occupation or service in terms of as it being work. So we're still to this day trying to make our profession valued and have these basic worker rights that all Americans have common for us. So it's valued work. However, we have to make it value in the eyes of society, because we know that the baby boomers are aging, and we know that the need for our services are here, but we also have to have our basic job security and rights.
So if you were to make a list of the basic benefits and issues around job security and rights, what are the top sort of two or three things on that list that you'd like to see? Yeah, go ahead.
Yes, a livable wage, benefits, you know, paid time off, if we have sick leave. Also, we would like to be recognized as, you know, professionals in terms of caring for your loved ones, your seniors, your people with disabilities. Those are very, very, and job protection also. Mm-hmm. If things arise in terms of harassment and those type of things, we could lose our job if we speak up and speak out.
So you're talking to me from Georgia, from Atlanta, Georgia, and I'm just wondering if the situation around home health care workers like yourself has improved somewhat in recent weeks or months during the pandemic. In other words, are you getting a sense that the political leaders, the policymakers, the public debate is acknowledging your situation and what you're calling for?
Working on the ground level, it feels the same in a sense. However, I am positive because I feel like a lot of what we go through and a lot of the issues that we have been speaking about for years and years are now coming out in the forefront, and people are now talking about them. And I feel like a lot of the leaders and the higher ups are seeing, and you know, because this thing, this COVID pandemic is affecting everyone. It's kind of like bringing us together in a sense as humans. And I feel really positive, and I feel like a lot of good things will come out of this eventually.
Well, one of the things we're going to be talking about later in the hour is the Essential Workers Bill of Rights, which is being proposed in Congress by a couple of members of Congress. We're going to be talking to one of them in a little while. So I think you're right about that people are beginning to pay attention to this. Linda, before I let you go, I want to ask you one question about the work that you do, the least understood aspect of your job. What do you want to say about that? What's important for people who are listening to this to understand what it is that you do in terms of caring for people?
I want people to understand that this is a calling. You have to have a empathy, a compassion, a love for human beings across the board to be a caregiver because you're loving people and you're caring for people that aren't related to you. However, you're providing the best care. You're a counselor, you're a nurse, you're a doctor, you're all of these things rolled into one in someone else's home. And it's not for everyone. And you spend a lot of your time with people who aren't your family members, and you give your all. And I think with that, a lot of people kind of confuse it with, okay, you're that type of person. You're a nurturer, you're a giver, you're a lover of people. And with that, they kind of feel like, okay, it's free, it's natural, it's what you do. Mm-hmm. However, this is our employment. This is how we provide for our families. This is us being away from our families. This is us having to work a lot of hours because we're not paid really great wages to do this type of work. However, we want to be treated and we want to be compensated well for what we do, because we're the front line and we're caring for your loved ones. And I want everyone to understand that we're not asking for handouts. We're not asking for people to feel sorry for us, but we want to be recognized and respected. And in doing so, we have basic rights just like any other workers in America.
Well, Linda Walton, I want to thank you very much for joining us today, for telling us a little bit about the work you do and the difficult situation faced by a lot of your fellow workers. I'm really grateful that you joined us today. Many thanks.
Thank you.
That's Linda Walton. She's a domestic worker in Georgia and a member of the organization We Dream in Black. She joined us from Atlanta, Georgia. Listeners, we're talking about the need for better protections, better pay, a piece of the safety net, I guess you could say, for America's home care workers. I'm Anthony Brooks. We're going to take a short break. We're going to talk a lot more about these issues in the hour ahead. This is On Point.
Support for the On Point podcast comes from Indeed. If you need to hire, you need Indeed. Indeed is your matching and hiring platform that lets you find candidates fast. Ditch the busy work and use Indeed for scheduling, screening, and messaging so you can connect with candidates faster. And listeners get a $75 sponsored job credit to get your jobs more visibility at Indeed.com/on point. That's Indeed.com/on point. Terms and conditions apply. Need to hire? You need Indeed. Support for this podcast comes from Is Business Broken, a podcast from BU Questrom School of Business. Listen on for a preview of one of the episodes.
ESG, or environmental social governance, challenges businesses to think beyond the immediate bottom line. But before ESG, the Balanced Scorecard did something similar. Questrom's Eddie Riedel explains.
The big thing that was groundbreaking about the Balanced Scorecard is really this idea to move beyond thinking about financial statements, which everybody had thought about since the 1920s, right? That was kind of the gold standard for how to evaluate a company and its performance. And the Balanced Scorecard's big insight, I think, was to get companies internally to think about, well, what if you don't just focus on financial measures? There are other things that are going to affect your performance, and maybe they won't affect them today, but they're going to affect them in the short term, midterm, long term. Building in those other criteria, those other dimensions, and explicitly linking that to your strategy, to how your company is going to operate, what kind of big decisions it's going to make. That's really what the big insight of the Balanced Scorecard was meant to do. And at the time, right now, it doesn't seem particularly revolutionary. It seems kind of obvious. We've been stuck in the ESG movement for a while, and thinking about linking these things to corporate strategy seems pretty obvious. At the time, it was a pretty big, whoa, kind of moment.
Find the full episode by searching for Is Business Broken wherever you listen to podcasts, and learn more about the Mehrotra Institute for Business, Markets, and Society at ibms.bu.edu.
This is On Point. I'm Anthony Brooks, and we're talking about the precarious situation for millions of domestic care workers across the country and the push for better pay and better protections. And we're talking about how that precariousness has been amplified by the pandemic right now. And joining me now from Chicago is Ai-Jen Poo. She is co-founder and executive director of the National Domestic Workers Alliance, the nation's leading nonprofit organization helping workers who care and clean in homes across the United States. Ai-Jen Poo, thank you so much for joining us. It's good to have you.
Thank you, Anthony.
There's a lot I want to talk to you about, but I know you were listening along to our conversation with Linda Walton, the domestic worker from Atlanta, Georgia. What did you hear in that conversation?
Well, I heard her talk about her work and how essential it is to millions of families. As somebody who is caring for the elderly and people with disabilities, she is providing a lifeline to some of the most vulnerable people in this COVID crisis, but every day providing support and services for the people that raised us, right? Our most important people in our lives. And it's the work that makes all other work possible. And yet we have not recognized or protected it. And now in this time of crisis, they are a lifeline for us and they're risking their lives.
And amplify that a little bit, expand on that. In what ways are they risking their lives? We heard Linda talking about a sort of lack of information about just how to keep herself safe early on during the pandemic, but still needing to go to work. That sounds terrifying. So there's that. What else are you thinking of?
Well, the COVID virus is continuing to spread around the country. And, home care workers like Linda are going to work every single day, providing life-saving services. And they are having to figure out, are they going to go on the bus? Or are they going to pay out of pocket for transportation? Maybe they don't have a car. And what are they going to do with their own children who are home from school? Are they going to take them with them to work, or what are their options? And their average wages are $16,000 per year. So the average annual income of a home care worker is $16,200 per year. So there's not a lot of room. There wasn't money to stock up on groceries, right, in this pandemic. There wasn't money to pay extra for transportation that's safer. And there's not a lot of money to pay out of pocket for protective equipment if you can get it, which many like Linda cannot. And they're exposing themselves constantly and trying to figure out how to keep themselves safe. And meanwhile, the bills are piling up.
You are director of the National Domestic Workers Alliance. You've got some 200,000 members, if I'm correct about that. I'd love you to give us a sort of sketch of the types of jobs that NDWA represents and who your members are.
Sure. So domestic workers are the nannies who take care of our children and the cleaners who maintain sanity and order in our homes, and the home care workers who take care of our loved ones with disabilities, make sure that they can live independently, our aging parents, our loved ones with chronic illnesses, anyone who does caregiving and cleaning services in the private home setting. And it's vast majority women, more than 92% women, and disproportionately Black women and other immigrant women of color. And it's work that has always been devalued. Linda talked about a long history of exclusion from basic rights and protections in the labor laws dating back to the New Deal. And so there's the legal exclusion from fairness and protection in the workplace. And then there's a cultural devaluing. This work has always been associated with work that women do in terms of caregiving and cleaning. And as a profession, it's always been associated with Black women, women of color. And we don't even refer to it as real work. We still refer to it as help, mm-hmm. right? Mm-hmm. And so the basic recognition that this is a profession for millions of women is something we're still fighting for. And not only is it a profession, but it turns out it's essential.
My guest this hour is Ai-Jen Poo. She's co-founder and executive director of the National Domestic Workers Alliance. That's a nonprofit organization helping workers who care and clean in our homes. Ai-Jen Poo, I heard Linda Walton talk about this fact that so many of these workers have been excluded from some of these basic benefits as a real legacy of slavery. I mean, mm-hmm. that's not an overstatement, is it?
Not in the slightest. In the 1930s, when Congress was about to enact our labor policies that would really be the cornerstone of worker protections in this country, the National Labor Relations Act and the Fair Labor Standards Act, Southern members of Congress refused to support those measures if they included protections for domestic workers and farm workers who were Black workers at the time. So in a concession to those Southern members of Congress, Congress actually enacted those laws excluding those workers. And that racial exclusion has really defined conditions in this workforce for generations. And we've been organizing in many, many states to try to pass domestic worker bills of rights. And 9 states have actually passed legislation to protect the rights of domestic workers. And yet we're still fighting for inclusion in 1930s labor laws because of how deep the racism has gone in our labor laws. And it meant that this critical workforce came into this crisis. We needed them to take care of us, and they've been taking care of us, and we have not taken care of them at all.
Ai-Jen Poo, I want to go to some callers. We've got some backed up. Let's go to Debbie, who's calling from Newton, Massachusetts, right outside of Boston. Debbie, it's good to have you. You're on the air.
Hi, thank you so much for taking my call. I'm so thrilled that you are bringing this to the attention of masses of people who may not have ever had the experience. My husband had a massive stroke March 2012, and shortly he was hospitalized for 6 months. I took care of him for about the first 6 months, and since then, so about the last 7.5 years, we've needed home health aides. He is completely immobile. Nobody's talking about, I don't hear the, maybe you don't want to say the dirty stuff that happens, but you know, this is not just taking care of people. My husband needs full care. This is cleaning up the poop, making sure that there's urination is being handled, making sure that the bathing is happening and the skin is clean so that it can stay intact so there are no bed sores, moving him with a Hoyer lift, making sure I'm at work all day, making sure his medication is given and on time, making sure that his meals are taken care of and that he's not choking, making sure when he has an itch, you're there to scratch it, for heaven's sakes. This is really extreme care for a lot of people, and I've been appalled. I wish I was making more money. I don't make much myself. That I could pay them what they're worth. It's appalling, appalling. We're in Massachusetts, for heaven's sakes. The rate of pay is disgraceful.
Well,
it's
Debbie,
not livable.
Debbie, I want to say a couple of things. First of all, I'm very sorry about your husband. I'm glad you've got the support of, I'm glad you've got some help. And thank you for putting, for being so descriptive and really talking about the work that these folks do. Thanks for your call. Agent Poo, I'd love to get you to respond to Debbie. She's talking about the level of really essential work. And one of the points that I know you make is this kind of help is only going to be needed more and more as the population ages.
That's right. I mean, I think Debbie is in the same boat with about 50 million other family caregivers who are really under crushing pressure to take care of their loved ones in this moment. And every single day in this country, 10,000 people turn 70 as the boomers age, right? And people are living longer than ever before because of advances in healthcare and medicine and technology. And so we've essentially added an entire generation onto our lifespan, but we have none of the support and infrastructure and policy in place to really make sure that that generation can live well and with dignity and get the care that they need. And workers like Linda, workers like the home care worker who's supporting Debbie, they are the human infrastructure that will enable a dignified quality of life for the older population in this country that is growing exponentially. But right now, what Debbie described in terms of that work and the texture of it, the intimacy of it, there are people like Linda who are incredible caregivers, but we lose many of them to other industries, other low-wage service industries like fast food and retail, because they cannot feed their families on the wages that they earn, literally cannot pay the bills. And so we have got to figure out how we invest in transforming these jobs into living wage jobs with benefits and real economic security for them and really for all of us.
So, Ai-Jen, I'd like to ask you what that looks like in terms of structuring our society in such a way that we can better pay these people. We heard Debbie talking about the extraordinary help she gets to care for her husband. But she said, for example, among the things she said is she doesn't have a lot of money to pay these folks. So what's the solution there? How does government sort of restructure itself to ensure that people like Debbie get the kind of support that they need and the people who provide that support get the kind of pay that they deserve?
I think that care is a public good and we should be investing in it as a public good, and that we should really think about care as infrastructure for the 21st century. If we think about infrastructure as that which enables commerce and everything else in our lives to happen, roadways, transportation, hubs, like that is all. What could be more fundamental to our society and our economy functioning than care? And if you think about home care jobs alone, investing in home care jobs and making them living wage jobs with benefits, if our goal coming out of the pandemic is to get America back to work again, making care jobs, living wage jobs with benefits, not only benefits those workers and their families, but these are job-enabling jobs. They make it possible for Debbie to go to work and for so many other Americans to get back to work. So if we were to invest public dollars anywhere, right, if we can make $500 billion in corporate giveaways happen, we can make home care jobs good jobs with benefits. And I think we should invest in that as a public good.
Let's take another call from Providence, Rhode Island. Nyoka is calling. Nyoka, I hope I'm pronouncing your name correctly. You're on the air. Thank you.
Hello. Thank you for taking my call. And you are pronouncing my name correctly.
Good. What's on your mind?
Well, I was telling my story to the lady that I spoke to, and I was telling her that, you know, at the age of 12, when I lived in Connecticut, I received my certification from the state of Connecticut to be a licensed babysitter. So at 12 years old, I was working for a couple of families in town, working on my weekends off from school. Fast forward to graduating high school, I received my CNA license and have been a CNA ever since. I am now 33. I'm trying to complete nursing school. I have a 3-year-old, and I've then enlisted the help of a family friend to help me with my child because, you know, I have a lot on my plate, and working night shift, it becomes very difficult. And I currently work in a mental health facility. So when it comes to equal pay for people who do the bare essential, what we call basic needs in healthcare, to tell us that we do not deserve to be paid adequately, where you can live adequately, take care of your children adequately without having the struggles of trying to figure out where your child's going to be, especially during this pandemic. Mm. It's really disheartening. It's very disheartening. It breaks my heart because you're asking me for every day of my life that I go into work to show the compassion and care to your family that you can't even give me.
Yeah.
So where does that put people in healthcare who work in healthcare, who aren't doctors, who aren't nurses, who do the bare minimum, but the essential
Nyoka, to everyday life
for these people?
I'm so glad you called, and I want to just ask you a follow-up question. All of these issues that you've put on the table are so compelling. How have you talk a little bit about how they've been amplified during the pandemic?
Well, most of the people that I work with, or most of the people I feel that I can attest to their testimony, I will say. I'm a minority. I'm a Black woman from Jamaica. I grew up in the United States. I went through the school system in Connecticut, went to college in Rhode Island at Rhode Island College for my degrees in psychology. I've done everything that would equate to assimilation to the American culture. That being said, when we try to go into the workforce, most of the jobs that we're able to get based on our qualifications or not are going to be jobs within healthcare or the food industry. So those are not high paying jobs, regardless of your degree. Those are not high paying jobs that would then allow you to have the flexibility of getting healthcare for your child. So most of the people that are minorities either have family members who take care of their children. When COVID happened, I wasn't able to bring my child to Connecticut so my parents could watch her, you know, while I still had to go to work. But these people depend on a childcare system, either through the state or a childcare system that they're paying out of pocket for. So when COVID happened, all of these people who are most likely or most are single parents or have other complications, such as children with disabilities who depend on the system, didn't have the care that they required because nobody was certain on how COVID was going to affect you going in and out of someone else's home when everybody else should be on quarantine.
Right. Nayoka, thank you so much for the call. We got to take a break, but I'm really grateful that you called in. You put a lot of important thoughts and issues on the table. Ijenpu, stand by. We're talking about the life for millions of domestic workers across the country and the nationwide push for protections, better pay, and a piece of the safety net. When we return, we're going to hear from Congressman Ro Khanna, co-author of An Essential Workers' Bill of Rights. Stay with us. I'm Anthony Brooks. This is On Point.
A gruesome scandal at the nation's most prestigious university shines a light on a macabre and lucrative world of buying and selling human remains.
Human body parts taken by a manager at the Harvard Medical School morgue and then sold to customers online.
So my first skull is right there on the top shelf. That's my first and my favorite.
I'm reporter Allie Jarmani, and this story raises some tough questions. How should we treat the dead? And who gets to decide?
There should be some middle ground where we treat deceased tissues differently than we treat old refrigerators.
This is Postmortem, The Stolen Bodies of Harvard, a new season of WBUR's Last Scene. Listen and follow Last Scene wherever you get your podcasts.
This is On Point. I'm Anthony Brooks. Tomorrow we're going to be talking about the rollbacks of environmental rules and regulations under the Trump administration. Do you live in an area where environmental inequity affects your health or your community's health? What questions do you have for our experts about the implications of these policies? Tell us your story by giving us a call at 617-353-0683. Again, that number is 617-353-0683. And we'll get you involved in tomorrow's program. Today, we're talking about the experience of America's home care workers and efforts at the state and federal level to provide these essential jobs with better protections and compensation. My guest is Ijenpu. She's co-founder and executive director of the National Domestic Workers Alliance, a nonprofit organization helping workers who care and clean our homes. And Ijenpu, one question before we move on to another guest. You mentioned that a few states have put together laws to help domestic workers. Which are they, and what do those laws look like?
There's nine of them. It would take me a while to name them. But New York was the first in 2010, and it's called the Domestic Workers Bill of Rights. And so it's the 10th anniversary of the passage of that law, and it provided 3 days paid time off per year, protection from discrimination and harassment, a day of rest per week, and inclusion in other basic labor rights that other workers enjoy in the state.
Wow. I mean, a day of rest a week. I mean, it's striking to me that, that we're just passing laws, in the last 10 years that give people the right for a day of rest a week. It's quite striking.
Listen, I think that domestic workers have been really at the forefront of what has been an epidemic of low-wage work that has been spreading over the last decades. And, you know, it's always been low-wage and insecure, no safety net, no paid time off for domestic workers. Mm. And increasingly, when you look around, more and more American jobs are just as insecure, without job security, without access to a safety net, without paid time off, and very low wages. Millions of people are working incredibly hard and still can't make ends meet. And we have been in denial about that or something. We haven't had political leadership on transforming low-wage work. And it really did take a pandemic to help us start to see how many of those low-wage jobs that have been invisible to us are actually essential. They have been keeping us safe, and they've been keeping this country moving forward in the midst of crisis.
Well, I want to bring into the conversation Representative Ro Khanna. He's a Democratic congressman representing California's 17th congressional district, and he's co-author, along with Senator Elizabeth Warren of Massachusetts, of legislation to help protect workers on the front lines of the pandemic. It's called the Essential Workers Bill of Rights. And Congressman Ro Khanna, welcome to On Points. Good to have you. Thanks for joining us.
Thanks, Anthony. Great to be on.
Yeah, I know. I think you've been listening along to some of this program, but I'd love you to sort of outline what this Bill of Rights for essential workers would look like.
Very simply put, it's about dignity of people who are doing vital work. We now know in the COVID crisis who is most essential. It's not the lawyers, it's not bankers, it's not members of Congress. It's people who are bringing us our groceries, picking up the trash, making sure we have electricity. Well, those workers, A, deserve fair pay. They're taking risks with their lives. They deserve hazard pay. They deserve a PPE protections. When I go to vote in Congress, I get a mask. I get gloves that are provided to me. Why can't every worker have that basic protection? They deserve to be consulted about what workplace safety looks like. There should be a standard about airborne pathogens. I mean, currently our government doesn't have a standard requiring businesses to regulate airborne pathogens, and these workers should be able to have bargaining rights and organizing rights. And that, in a nutshell, is what the Essential Worker Bill of Rights does.
Right, and would domestic workers, home care workers, the kind of workers that we've been talking about in this hour, would they be included in this?
They absolutely would be included, and that's, of course, they are essential, too. I mean, they are taking care of people's kids. They're taking care of people who are sick. They're taking care of the elderly. They deserve fair pay. They deserve to have child care. I mean, many of these individuals are raising two families. They're raising their own families, and then they're raising the families of people who they're helping. They should have child care, and they all should have health care. I mean, how you can have a pandemic and not provide people with health care is unconscionable. I think there is an opportunity. Our society is awake to the fact that these workers are critical. There are 60 million Americans who are doing physical labor in a digital age. And for so long, we've ignored those workers. We've taken them for granted. Now we realize their value, and we need to deliver on what they deserve.
Congressman, why has it taken a pandemic for so many people, or at least for some people, to recognize the value of this work? I guess another way of asking the question is, why wasn't the value of this work recognized by, I don't know, even enough of your colleagues to do, your fellow legislators, to do more about this before we got to this point?
Well, Anthony, people like Andrew, who you've had on, and people in my district in Silicon Valley have been organizing for almost a decade. I mean, in Silicon Valley, you have Apple and Google creating some of the greatest wealth the world has ever seen, and yet you have janitors, bus drivers, security guards not having a livable wage, a family-supporting wage, not having access often to health care. And there's a group, Silicon Valley Rising, that for decades has been saying, wait, there are a lot of people who are left out of this economy. But I think when we're in our busy lives, we often don't take the time to appreciate how much work is being done by these essential workers and how our economy will literally grind to a halt. And COVID was sort of a forced experiment, which allowed us to see what people like Dr. King have always understood, the dignity of labor and the importance of labor and how all work has value. And so the question now that we have this insight is, will we act on it? Will this just be a momentary phase of appreciation, or is it going to lead to structural change that so many activists have been working on for years?
And with regard to a divided Congress and how a divided Congress will react to this, what's your best guess? Do you think that there will be a serious sort of legislative response to this? I mean, you and Elizabeth Warren have co-authored this Essential Workers Bill of Rights. My guess is it could fare pretty well in the House. Maybe the Senate is another story. What do you think?
Well, in the House, we've passed many of the provisions in the HEROES Act. The Senate is an uphill battle, but I've said that there's room for a bipartisan compromise. I mean, McConnell keeps talking about having liability protection for businesses. Well, you're not going to just give blanket liability protection to businesses without requiring them to have some plan in regulating airborne pathogens, without having some plan to provide PPE. So what I've said is, if you adopt Senator Warren and my Essential Workers Bill of Rights that so many groups and workers have help shape, then maybe you can have a safe harbor for businesses. If businesses comply with these four or five things, then they would have a safe harbor to protect them from liability. So there's a possibility to get a bipartisan deal. Of course, McConnell and the Republicans have to be willing to come to the table.
Congressman, before I let you go, I just want to invite Agent Poo to ask you a question, if she wants to. Agent Poo, is there a question you have for Congressman Khanna?
I want to know what we can do as everyday people to try to get the HEROES Act through the Senate.
Well, first, let me just say Agent was instrumental in crafting the Essential Workers Bill of Rights and helped us both with the policy, and her organization has just been extraordinary for decades in helping get the stories out there. And I think that's what you can do, Agent, is to highlight more of the stories. I mean, the call you organized with Senator Warren and me, where we heard from the black woman who was working at Amazon, going there, working 12-hour shifts, didn't have PPE, was not being able to socially distance, wasn't getting a fair wage. People need to understand this. People need to understand. I mean, I get Amazon packages. We need to understand anyone who benefits from the system is in some ways responsible. We're all benefiting from the work these individuals are doing, and yet they're not getting the dignity they deserve. And I think Senator Warren and I can say only so much, and we'll be seen as policy people. But the more folks hear the actual stories of what work is being done, and in some cases the atrocious conditions, I think the more outcry there'll be in this country to do the right thing.
Well, Congressman Ro Khanna, he represents California's 17th Congressional District. He's co-author of the proposed Essential Workers Bill of Rights, along with Massachusetts Senator Elizabeth Warren, to help protect laborers on the front lines of the coronavirus pandemic and elsewhere. Congressman Ro Khanna, thanks so much for joining us today. We appreciate your time.
Thank you for having me on.
And Agent Poo, we've got some more callers who I'd like to get into this conversation before our time runs out. Let's go to Gigi. She's calling from Sarasota, Florida. Gigi, go ahead. You're on the air. Thanks for the call.
Hey, how's it going? Thank you so much for having me. I just have one quick issue with my experience in this COVID crisis. Often enough, when we go to a house, we have to choose between our own health and the health of others, and I'll describe it very quickly, very easily. So I have to choose between buying myself hand sanitizer or diluting my cleaning products. And I'm always going to choose having efficient and effective cleaning products. So often enough after a job, we're spraying our hands with bleach. And that's just not safe. But we're going to choose you over us every time. So every time you come home, you have a clean home. I work with an immigrant-based family-run house cleaning company. And more than often enough, we're stuck with that situation, and we're always going to choose the people over us. And I feel like that's just not right sometimes.
Well, Gigi, thank you for the call. We appreciate it, and we wish you good luck. I want to take another call. Let's go to Steph, who's calling from East Hampton, Massachusetts. Steph, go ahead. You're on the air. Thanks for the call.
Hey, thanks for having me, and thanks for taking my call. I've been listening in Massachusetts from East Hampton, and I'm just struck by Linda's story and all of the people who have been sacrificing so much to be childcare providers specifically, which I am one of. And I think that people need to understand that it's impossible to live on one salary in the state of Massachusetts as a single person. I was a preschool teacher for 5 years, but when my relationship ended and I had to move out on my own, I was not able to afford to pay for rent and food, and I just wasn't able to live on my own. And with the attention given to child care and elder care and home care, I think I'm hoping that it's not just a flash in the pan, thank you, oh, we so appreciate you. I really hope that it's something that people understand is so essential that when I go to work and take care of kids, they are my responsibility. I am responsible for the bare minimum, keeping them alive, which, you know, if you think about it, is a pretty big order, but also for helping them become a member of society and for helping them to learn and establish self-esteem and confidence and bonds and things that they're going to need way past the time that I'm in their lives. And it's just priceless to me, and I just don't understand why people think that it's not a real job. You know, like, when are you going to get a real job is something that I'm asked frequently.
Steph, well, thank you. Of course, it is real work, and we appreciate the fact that you do this work, and thank you for calling in as well. Agent Poo, I want to come back to you. You know, we heard Congressman Ro Khanna talking about the possibility of moving something through Congress. Are you optimistic that this moment, because of this moment, because of the pandemic, because of programs like this, because people may be gaining new awareness about this, that you're going to see progress on these issues?
I've been working on these issues for 25 years almost, and I've never seen the level of awareness and appreciation for what low-wage workers do for this country and just how essential so much work that's been invisible to us truly is to our lives and our economy and the future of our country. And I think that we have this once in several generations opportunity to value and protect that work and to restore dignity to work in America. And it's up to us. It's not inevitable by any stretch of the imagination. But I do think that this new majoritarian awareness that we have right now is everything we need to make good jobs, good work, quality work, our future.
Mm. Is the fact that the pandemic is accompanied by a devastating economic crisis as well, which might make politicians less eager to sort of open up new sources of funding for something like this. Is there concern there in your view?
Well, I think what we've learned is that economies can't function without workers. Mm-hmm. And if we don't invest in our workers in this country, first and foremost, what future do we really have? What choice do we really have? And so I can understand the concern, but I actually think that that's a false choice. I don't think that we have any choice but to really value and protect workers in this country across all industries, especially the essential industries, especially the people who care for us.
Well, Agent Poe, thank you so much for joining us today. We're very grateful for your time and for bringing these issues to us. They're important.
Thank you, Anthony.
Agent Poo is co-founder and executive director of the National Domestic Workers Alliance, the nation's leading nonprofit organization helping workers who care and clean in homes across the country. You can join the conversation, get the On Point podcast at our website, onpointradio.org, and you can follow us on Twitter, find us on Facebook, and On Point Radio. This program is made possible by a very productive and talented group of people: Anna Bauman, Melissa Egan, Eileen Amata, Brittany Knotts, Liam Knox, Stefano Katsonis, Hillary McQuilkin, James Ross, Dory Scheimer, Tim Skog, Grace Tatter, Adam Waller, and Sydney Wertheim. Thank you for your excellent support. I'm Anthony Brooks. This is On Point.
Support for this podcast comes from Is Business Broken?, a podcast from BU Questrom School of Business. Listen on for a preview of one of the episodes.
ESG, or environmental social governance, challenges businesses to think beyond the immediate bottom line. But before ESG, the Balanced Scorecard did something similar. Questrom's Eddie Riedel explains.
The big thing that was groundbreaking about the Balanced Scorecard is really this idea to move beyond thinking about financial statements, which everybody had thought about since the 1920s, right? That was kind of the gold standard for how to evaluate a company and its performance. And the Balanced Scorecard's big insight, I think, was to get companies internally to think about, well, what if you don't just focus on financial measures? There are other things that are going to affect your performance, and maybe they won't affect them today, but they're going to affect them in the short term, midterm, long term. Building in those other criteria, those other dimensions, and explicitly linking that to your strategy, to how your company is going to operate, what kind of big decisions it's going to make, that's really what the big insight of the Balanced Scorecard was meant to do. And at the time, right now, it doesn't seem particularly revolutionary. It seems kind of obvious. We've been stuck in the ESG movement for a while, and thinking about linking these things to corporate strategy seems pretty obvious. At the time, it was a pretty big whoa kind of moment.
Find the full episode by searching for Is Business Broken? Wherever you listen to podcasts, and learn more about the Mehrotra Institute for Business, Markets, and Society at ibms.bu.edu.